Let's go to take a walk.
Recently, the New York Society for Acoustic Ecology had the opportunity to offer free hearing screenings to its members and friends, courtesy of the League for the Hard of Hearing. Following the screenings, Elliot Berger, senior scientist for auditory research at EAR Aero Technologies Company, presented us with a lecture on hearing loss and hearing protection. After having my own ears tested and learning that while my hearing is excellent, I've got a profusion of earwax deemed in excess of normal, I sat down for a chat with Elliot, who has been in the business of protecting ears for some 30 years. We were joined by Nancy Nadler, Director of Development at the League for the Hard of Hearing, and Amy Boyle, the League's Director of Public Education. Following are a few excerpts of that conversation.
Could one of you just clarify for me what an audiologist is?
You can help me out with this, but an audiologist is a professional who tests hearing, identifies hearing loss, and makes recommendations for the treatment of hearing loss, including hearing aids and assistive listening devices.
So an audiologist is who you see first when you have a hearing test?
The audiologist is a person, a licensed audiologist is a person you'd want to go to see if you have a question about your hearing, and they would be able to give you a complete hearing evaluation, yes.
They often work in conjunction with a physician who would be an ear, nose, and throat specialist, an otologist or an otolaryngologist, who would be more interested in medical disorders of the ear. If there was some work that an ENT were to conduct, often there is some testing or rehabilitation that's needed thereafter, and so there's usually audiologists in most ENT clinics, or perhaps all ENT clinics.
It's interesting statistic that I recently read that only 16% of physicians ever ask people about their hearing when they have their physicals, and so it's really important that people really pay attention to their hearing, and that if they have any questions, they should see an audiologist, and certainly ask their physician, but the audiologist is the person you want to see for the hearing test. Mm.
I'm sure it doesn't occur to most people to even think about asking their physician about their hearing in the first place.
And we're from that statistic, physicians aren't asking their patients either about their hearing.
Right. Well, today, so we know today members of NICE are having the hearing tested. Can you, Elliot, just describe that basic test and kind of what its purpose is?
The basic test that the members of your organization are having today is what's called an audiogram or an air conduction audiogram. They wear earphones that generate single tone sounds, pure tones, and the person is asked to respond to the quietest sounds they can detect. So it is a threshold measurement experiment. It's called the threshold of hearing. And this test then characterizes their hearing relative to population norms, and indicates whether there's any potential problems there. So it'd be the most basic type of hearing test. There are a whole battery of hearing tests that might follow that, but this is the first one that people would have.
Mm-hmm. Do you guys encounter hearing loss issues here that might be different from hearing loss issues that you encounter, say, in your Florida office or in more rural areas? Are there city-specific issues you deal with here?
There can be. Just riding the subway every day to work can possibly damage hearing because of the decibel levels that we've taken in the New York City subway system. We're experiencing perhaps noise levels that other people in other areas wouldn't. The other thing is you notice on the subway, a lot of people wearing the MP3 players, the Walkmans, the iPods, and of course they're having to raise that volume up to compensate for the noise around them. And so if they're listening to it in a quiet suburban, you know, neighborhood, they're probably not going to be playing it as loud as they are if they're out on a New York City street. Mm. So I think those are just two examples.
It's interesting that you asked that question because one of the aspects of noise as a pollutant is that it's incredibly pervasive. Certainly the examples that Amy suggested are good ones. And in terms of annoyance, this is New York has the potential to be a more annoying acoustic environment than a rural community. In terms of hearing loss, my suspicion is that you might well find more hearing loss in a rural community because of the prevalence of work on a farm, which is a very noisy and dangerous place to work. And whether you're running a combine, a tractor, or all of the equipment that's used on a farm, a number of studies have looked at agricultural hearing loss in the agricultural communities, and it's very high. And their leisure time activities might be shooting guns or doing some other things that are noisy, so there are many things in the world that make noise.
That's interesting. There are my assumptions about what's noisy and what's quiet. That's interesting.
And part of that is because noise, by definition, is unwanted sound. So if you're in a place that you're perceiving to be noisy, such as, you know, a city street where you want to have a conversation with someone and the sirens are going by, you're going to be paying attention to that noise a whole lot more than, as Elliot said, if you're involved in an activity that it could be more damaging to your hearing, perhaps, but it's something that is recreational, so you're enjoying it. So there's two kinds of definitions. One is the idea of noise that is damaging to hearing. The other is the annoyance factor that you brought up, that is the perceived annoyance of sound and the unwanted sound.
Mm-hmm. So actually, with respect to the hearing damage, it would be better to talk about sound as opposed to noise, because perhaps the ultimate example of the pleasurable sound that is potentially damaging are people who play music professionally.
Mm-hmm.
And more we're looking at professional musicians, and perhaps to some extent concert attenders, but more often professional musicians, needing to be aware of protecting their hearing from the beautiful things they're creating.
I think it also probably has to do with the how long you're exposed. I mean, it also seems like if you're working on a farm, you're working in a factory, you become really used to it, and you do it every day, and it's this ongoing thing. Whereas when I ride the subway, I don't spend that much time down there, and when the subway comes in, I plug my ears, and, you know, when a siren goes by, I plug my ears. It's just a short burst of noise, and plug them up.
I have a question about plugging your ears that I want to ask actually Elliot.
Yeah.
And for you, when you say you plug your ears, you mean you just block your ears with your hands?
Yes.
And so from your perspective, Elliot, does that offer much in the way of hearing protection?
Actually, fingers in the ears are a very good hearing protector. You can't do anything else while you're using them, but we have tested them, and they're worth about 25 dB. So it's a good hearing protector. However, you said something that caused me to smile, which is you talked about the response to noise has to do with how often you're exposed to it. And absolutely, in terms of hearing damage, it's an issue of the level of the sound and the duration of the exposure. But in terms of the phrase you used, get used to it, you don't adapt to noise in terms of it harming you. You get deaf. Some people have the thought that you can tough it out, toughen your ears, and that doesn't happen.
Yeah,
when
no,
people
I definitely
would say
don't think that.
They would say they would go to concerts, and concerts used to bother their ears. They would come out, and their ears used to ring after
right.
going to concert, but now it doesn't bother them anymore because they got used to it.
Right.
It's not really that they got used to it. It's that they're not hearing. Those hair cells are not responding anymore
yes.
because they're damaged.
The olfactory sense will adapt. You know, you walk into a motel room that doesn't smell quite right, you're there for a while unless it's an awful odor, you end up sort of getting used to it. And annoying sounds that are not hazardous sounds in your workplace or elsewhere, often people will adapt to them.
Like the hum of a refrigerator. Right. You will adapt. You'll forget that it's there. There are many people, though, that don't adapt to those sounds and have trouble with them, and we have actually a tinnitus and a hyperacusis center here for people to help them with that issue where those kinds of sounds or whether the ringing in the ears or hyperacusis is difficult for them. So at the League for the Art of Hearing, we have that program as well.
Radio listeners, in case you're wondering what is hyperacusis, here are a few thoughts from Elliot Berger.
It's an unusual, I'd say something that really in the last 10 years has been identified and mentioned, where people who have nominally normal hearing have an averse sensitivity to sounds even at moderate levels. So something like washing your dishes, they might have to put towels on the countertops so their dishes, when they put it down, don't create
wow.
problems for them. And hazardous noises of the type that are impulsive are among the most damaging, potentially, because it can be a one-time explosion. The one that comes to mind is driving a car and your airbag goes off, and there are a number of people who've had auditory injuries, hyperacusis, tinnitus, as a result of airbag discharge in their automobiles. And for those people, suddenly their lives have been totally turned on end because of the inability to interact, you know, needing to wear hearing protection to walk outdoors or to be around your grandkids.
Aside from, like you mentioned, farmers being a particular group that tends to suffer hearing loss, are there other kinds of demographics or groups of people that in particular you find there's maybe generationally or work-related that you find particularly hearing loss issues in?
There are about probably 6 to 8 million people who work in hazardous noise in this country. And so certainly as a group, whether it's in the automotive manufacturing, woodworking, agriculture, as I mentioned, textile industry, oil and gas, there's many industries where there are high levels of noise and people are at risk. And one of the best ways to identify those noises is if it's an environment in which it's loud enough that at arm's length you have to shout to be heard, it's probably around 85 dB or greater in sound pressure level. And those are the levels that for regular exposures people are likely to lose hearing due to noise.
And that's a good rule of thumb outside of the workplace too, though. if you're at home and you notice that you have to shout in order to be heard when your children are listening to their MP3 players or their stereo, then it's too loud and it's potentially damaging for their hearing.
The iPod issue has certainly captured the media's attention, especially in the last 6 months. There are limited data on that device per se. For years, however, since the 1970s, we've had a similar means of presenting sound at the ear, which is the Walkman. So personal stereo systems and earphones have not substantially changed in terms of the sound that they can present. The issue is now that you can play them longer and more people are using them. And hearing loss is related, as I said, to level and duration.
It's my understanding, you're absolutely right, because they're smaller. These iPods, they're smaller, they're more portable, and people can listen to them for 1,000 hours as opposed to one disc that you put in your Discman. But it's also my understanding that they're actually they're louder than previous personal.
There are some earphone designs. I mean, many of them are no different. There are some earphone designs that can play at somewhat higher sound pressure levels.
Up to about 120 to 125 decibels is one study that
I would not accept that level.
Okay.
Issues in how you measure the sound pressure levels. It's a tricky technical issue in how to do that, and what you measure in your device has to be adjusted to correspond to the way we describe sound in terms of hearing risk. So I would say that levels maybe 105, 110 could be played in terms of that issue. There's no question that there are a small percentage. The existing studies would suggest maybe 10-15% of the users who play them either at levels or durations that can cause hearing loss. There are really no studies of merit in the last couple years, as this new craze has come upon us, that have characterized exactly what sort of durations and levels people are using. Mm-hmm. There's one researcher in Boston who's done some interesting work in a laboratory scenario and has some good data. There are ongoing studies, and in fact we might be involved in a study here in the future to try and learn more about it. So it's an important question. There's a measure of caution that should be taken. I think that there's a bit of exaggeration right now in the media about it.
There's some common sense that you can kind of apply to this, in that knowing that continued exposure to noise causes hearing loss, and that the louder the sound, the less time that it will take before damage occurs. Those are kind of general rules. If you're listening to music that's loud, using your rule of thumb, you have to shout in order to be heard when someone's just 3 feet away for hours and hours and hours, it's not good for your hearing. Turn it down. I mean, it's a basic general kind of rule of thumb. And err on the side of safety, in the sense that why wait until you develop a hearing loss to do something about it, because it's too late. There's nothing you can do at that point. The damage is permanent. So I guess until those studies come in, I would say err on the side of safety and turn down the volume and limit the exposure.
And along the line of the common sense rules, two others which your listeners can easily apply for themselves. We mentioned, without really describing what it was, the term tinnitus, which is a noise in the ears in the absence of actual sounds around you. And that noise can take the form of ringing, hissing, humming, throbbing, sorts of sounds. Many people will hear tinnitus perhaps when they go to bed at night or occasionally in a very quiet environment. However, generally during the day it's not something you notice. If you go to a concert or you've played your earphones and immediately after that experience there's this experience of tinnitus, it's kind of like sunburn of the skin. You've given a sound burn to your inner ear hair cells. And if you do that on a regular basis, it's likely that the tinnitus will become permanent and that it will be accompanied by a hearing loss. So if you're causing that to occur in your ears, it's a warning sign. Another one that is not quite as apparent is that if after noise exposure you feel a fullness in your ears, or you notice that your hearing's kind of muffled and you have a little bit more difficulty hearing somebody, that also is an indicator of what's called a temporary hearing loss. By definition, temporary hearing losses recover. However, repeated temporary hearing losses tend not to recover and to become permanent. So it's another warning indicator that a person can use themselves. Another one would be call somebody like Nancy or Amy and get an audiogram. People often don't have hearing screenings. Yeah. In fact, I think the American Speech Hearing Language Association's recommendation is that at age 50 you should start having them, your first one, and have it every decade. But somebody whose hearing is important to them or thinks that they may be doing hearing risky behaviors, it's not at all difficult to make an appointment with an audiologist.
Mm-hmm. And we provide free hearing screenings twice a week at the League, on Tuesdays and Thursdays.
And anybody can just come in and...
They can call and make an appointment, and or they can email us, and they can come in, they get a free hearing screening, and it's a pass-fail, and so they'll know, yes, their hearing is normal, or no, that it's something's going on and they need further evaluation.
This seems like a good place to let you know that if you'd like to visit the League for the Hard of Hearing to have one of their free hearing screenings, they're located at 50 Broadway on the 6th floor. That's in Lower Manhattan near Wall Street. Their telephone number is 917-305-7700, and they're also on the web at www.lhh.org. And you should definitely check them out. Occasionally, they sponsor a mobile hearing testing unit, which can be found on the streets of New York City. It was recently spotted near City Hall as part of International Noise Awareness Day, which took place this past Wednesday, April 26th. This is the 11th year of International Noise Awareness Day. And here's Amy Boyle to tell us a little bit more about that.
It's International Noise Awareness Day. It's the 11th International Noise Awareness Day. It started as a grassroots effort by Nancy Nadler and developed across the country and actually internationally. There are events that go on in Thailand and Puerto Rico. And where the League sets the date each year, at this point the organizations that have been involved over the years are taking it and they just jump off and use it to highlight whatever issue they have, whether it's to go into schools and educate school children about the importance of protecting their hearing, or whether it's to offer free hearing screenings, or if there's a community issue, such as leaf blowers in Los Angeles was one year. Whatever the issue is for that community group, they can use this day as a jumping off point to help educate the people around them to protect their hearing and their health by paying attention to the noise and levels, sound levels around them.
You guys, do you do something 1 minute of silence during Noise Awareness Day? How does that work?
The Quiet Diet from 2:15 to 2:16, we try and ask everyone to be quiet just for that minute to try and get an idea of how lovely it would be if some of the sounds that are around us might not be around us.
And we've actually had the mayor of New York City participate in that with us at different times in the past 11 years, and it was really an experience, a moment of no noise.
And it's amazing how long that minute sometimes seems to be.
Speaking of noise, both Nancy and Amy have worked with the mayor on the recent updates to the noise code, and I asked them to talk a little bit about that and the progress of it, and also to let us know what the status of the noise code is now.
The noise code in New York City has really not been revised since it was first written, and it no longer met the needs of the people of New York. People would complain. The Department of Environmental Protection would go out and try to address the complaint, but a lot of times their hands were tied because the noise was not in violation of what was in the noise code. And as part of a group facilitating a lot of activists in the city, we worked with the Department of Environmental Protection and the mayor's office to try to look at the noise code so that it could meet the needs of New Yorkers. We worked with Arlene Bronzaft, who's the noise maven in New York City, and Eric Zwirling, who worked very closely on the noise code, and a lot of other individuals worked on the noise code to get it to where it is now. And Amy, if you want to talk about that, because I know you're very involved in this.
Well, what happened was is they got together, they have the revision, they put it before City Council, and it went through being looked at from a number of different agencies. And actually, at the end of December, it was signed into law. So at this point, we have a new noise code. However, it's going to take several years before it's totally implemented because it's going to be taking training of police officers and enforcement to know how to address it, informing building groups and everyone that would be involved in it, just what they need to do. But it has been approved by the City Council, and Mayor Bloomberg signed it into law at the end of December.
And who's responsible for implementing it, teaching all those people about it? And
I think that would probably be the Department of Environmental Protection will be taking the lead on that, and certainly the League for the Hard of Hearing, wherever they can help educate people, would be there as well, at their service to help in that education.
I mean, I ask partly because it feels like a rich area for people who are concerned about noise, who want to get active, you know, to somehow get active in facilitating that process of getting the word out, of making the code more publicly accessible, making people understand what their rights are, what they can do. I mean, I myself, you know, sometimes I call 311 to make a complaint about a truck or some horn or something, and it's kind of a mysterious process, and it's often not clear where my complaint is headed, and I'm often not given really any decent information about the process. And I think often the person I'm talking to doesn't know either. So,
right. Well, the Department of Environmental Protection has been doing some meetings, which I just heard about the other day, with some different community groups and community districts as a form of getting this education started. The other thing is the League, a number of years ago, the Noise Center put together a noise response. This was before 311 came about. So if people have certain issues, we've been able to help facilitate it. But I always advise people, call 311. The more calls 311 gets in regard to noise complaints and issues, the more they will realize the importance of it. And I believe they are now tracking the noise complaints and what they're getting and what the issue is, whether it's neighbor noise or siren noise, and being able to look at that, look at the new code, and move forward. And again, it's a process. So the more people are responsive to making that complaint, I believe the more responsive 311 will be, and they'll be able to forward this information to DEP that can then get the ball rolling in their court.
So really just take the time and make the call. And
noise is a leading quality of life complaint in New York City. Over 80% of the calls that go to the quality of life number that you're talking about are about noise.
Okay, listeners, if it's not totally obvious, when you have a noise complaint, something that's driving you nuts or that's just a little bit annoying, you should pick up the phone and call 311. It's a free call. It does take a few minutes, but like Amy and Nancy say, it definitely makes a difference in registering the complaint and getting the numbers accounted for in terms of the noise levels. Okay, enough of that. Now back to the rest of our interview.
Something I've been considering for a while now is trying to understand why people behave the way they do in public space and why people are so insensitive to the impact that they make on others' private space.
You mean like on talking on cell phones,
talking
on the train?
Talking on cell phones, and walking into a waiting room with your kids and being just, not only just children, not like children's laughter and children's noise, but like shouting at your children or just talking at a really high volume in a room full of other people who are reading magazines and being quiet. And it's kind of, I just am really, because I spent a lot of time in waiting rooms recently, I'm just curious why it is that people don't seem to notice. Because what it feels like to me is people aren't aware that they make an impact on the space when they enter into it. Like, you look a certain way, you smell a certain way, you sound a certain way when you walk into a room. And why is it that people don't seem to care about how they sound and the noise that they make? And my sort of hypothesis that I've been playing around with is that if a person's sense of self-esteem and self-worth is not very high, maybe they don't even consider that they make an impact. So when they walk into a room, it's like it doesn't even occur to them that they're entering that space might be noticed or might be meaningful or might have an impact on others. And so I've sort of been contemplating that as one possible reason why someone can walk into a room and just be so loud and not seem to notice. And that's my hypothesis, but I wondered if you had ideas about that.
I'm not sure. I don't have the answer, but I find it very interesting if we were to take just a snapshot of people walking around the city 10 years ago and compare it to a snapshot of people walking around the city today, we would see something very different. Because today, compared to 10 years ago, everybody's got something plugged into their ears, whether it's a Bluetooth or their iPod or a cell phone. I mean, everybody has all of this noise, all this stimulation. It's almost as though without it, they would be tense. They've got to be connected all the time. I don't know if that creates a situation where people are more involved in themselves at that moment, and so they're not seeing everything around them, including other people, because they're getting all that information from their BlackBerry and their cell phone and everything else, that they don't just stop. When you say you're in a waiting room and you're looking at a magazine and you've stopped for a minute, whereas other people have not stopped. They're continuing everything. They're moving. They're busy and they're doing everything all at the same time. So they might not take the time to also be aware of how that impacts everyone around them. But I find it interesting just to take a visual snapshot is so different. Everyone's got something plugged into their ears.
I don't know that I differentiate someone being inconsiderate with their noise versus being inconsiderate in general. I think about the people I see who litter on the street. I couldn't imagine, for me, littering on the street would be like I'd be sitting in your living room, I'm over at your house visiting, and I throw a piece of garbage on your carpet. Other people, it's the way they act. It's an irrelevancy.
But we've done a lot of education about littering. Lots and lots and lots of education. So people, I hope, know that's wrong. I think we need to do the same kind of education about noise. Because if someone is talking loudly on the train, on their cell phone, and it bothers everyone, and you hear all these personal conversations and business deals and things you don't want to hear necessarily, you hope they don't want you to hear. I wonder if we stopped and said, excuse me, that's really bothering me, how they might react. Would they be inconsiderate, or is it just a question of having to educate people that is inconsiderate?
Well, Les Blomberg of Noise Pollution Clearinghouse would certainly be happy to hear you calling noise oral litter. So,
I think it's also cultural, because like that person who comes in and is talking loudly on their cell phone or talking at full volume to their partner probably is dressed really, well, and wants to look good visually and wants to smell good and be clean. Like the appearance issues, people, culturally it's not acceptable to be all stinky and look like a mess, but culturally somehow it's acceptable to come in and be really loud. It's less of a kind of...
Well, if you're talking about the cell phone thing, I could also imagine a self-importance that I'm important enough, I need to be talking to this person. There's also a technology issue in that you may have trouble communicating on the cell phone, and one of the ways to improve your signal to noise ratio is to increase your speech level. There are devices today that are more sophisticated that are noise-canceling mics and boom-mounted, and the common ear-mounted mics, because of where the mic sits, it's picking up a fair amount of environmental noise as well as your speech. So there are some potential technology solutions as well.
And maybe it's a little different talking about cell phones versus just generally people who are just loud. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if there's one answer to the question. I think there could be a combination of being inconsiderate, being self-involved, being just not knowing, not realizing how loud they're being, needing education about this. I think it's a combination of things. I think people are very busy and sometimes only see where they have to go and they don't see anything else around them. And if anybody stopped them, they might say, oh, I'm so sorry, and they didn't realize, as opposed to someone who's just really rude. I don't think there's one answer.
You didn't ask an important question, so I need to just say a few words about...
Please.
Something that we can all personally do about our experience of noise, which is to wear hearing protection. And I think it would be useful if people thought about hearing protection like sunglasses. You have your glasses with you, so if it's too bright and it's uncomfortable to look out on a sunny day, you've got those available. And people should think about having earplugs with them for the times they need them, whether it's the noisy subway trip or an unexpectedly loud public event, concert, tractor pole, WrestleMania at the Madison Square Garden, or whatever it is, that you could have hearing protection available when you'd like it. And there are hearing protectors that don't block there's some that block a lot of sound. Hearing protectors don't make you unable to hear anything. They don't block all noise, but there are varieties that block a lot of sound for very hazardous exposures like shooting weapons, and there's others that are intended to block only a moderate amount of sound that would be more suitable for music exposures or moderate annoyance. Many good websites to get information for that, and so I think people need to be aware of another piece of safety equipment that isn't as commonly used as many others today.
Mm. Elliot, you made a couple of analogies of noise and hearing to sun exposure. I think it's a really great analogy because we would never consider going out into the sun now without putting some kind of sunblock on. Whereas years ago, that was something that people did all the time. And as a result, people have different susceptibilities to having damage from the sun. But years ago, if you were out in the sun and you had a sunburn, and it would get better, just like a temporary shift in hearing might get better. But continued exposure to that sun could cause damage later on. People get, you know, skin cancer and all other kinds of problems. And the same kind of thing is true with hearing protection. I think you're absolutely right. You wouldn't consider going out in the sun without some kind of sunblock these days. I mean, even lotion has the SP 15. Same thing, as you're going to go out, keep those earplugs with you and treat it the same way, because years later you don't want to be coming in with a hearing loss that is permanent. For all the years that we have given out earplugs on Noise Awareness Day all through the city, we never find them on the ground. People love them. They don't throw them away, ever, in all of the years. And that was the one thing people would say on Noise Awareness Day. You can hand things out, but if there's papers around, you have to be responsible for cleaning them up. We've never, ever had to clean up with earplugs. People love them.
Funny.
They love them.
I'm not surprised. I love them.
Good note to end on.
You've been listening to some excerpts from a conversation I had recently with Elliot Berger, senior scientist at EAR Aerotechnologies Company, and Nancy Nadler and Amy Boyle from the League for the Hard of Hearing. My name is Michelle Nagai. I'm a member of the New York Society for Acoustic Ecology, and I was speaking with Elliot, Amy, and Nancy on the occasion of a visit that our group paid to the League for the Hard of Hearing to have our hearing tested. I'd like to say thank you to Elliot Berger for helping me to organize this event and make it a reality, and also for giving us a pretty hearty supply of free earplugs. And of course, I'd like to thank Amy Boyle and Nancy Nadler, along with everybody at the League for the Hard of Hearing. Thanks for listening.
is here.
Hi.
Todd Brooks.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Williams.
Oh, what's that machine?
It's an ATA-22.
She's recording it all, man.
Yep.
She's recording our whole conversation.
Okay.
Yep. We can always just go outside and hear that noise.
Well, we can do that. We have a window open in our office.
Mm-hmm.
But, so anyway, I don't know what the...
You can talk a little bit about what you guys do. You're here.
What all right. Do we go someplace quiet so you can...
It's up to you. It's up to you. It's up to your coworkers.
Go someplace quiet first.
Where are we going? What is this?
Oh, this? Well, this is a conference room that's been converted by Todd, and he can tell you about the experiment he's been doing.
These heavy velvet curtains.
Yeah.
Let's see out the doors.
It's not quite top secret. Yeah, there are a few things I can tell you.
Okay.
So.
Have a seat.
Yes, please. Have
All
a seat.
All right. How much time do you guys have?
Oh, we got plenty of time,
like
right, Todd? It's no problem.
Yeah.
It's our tech.
Half hour for us to
Everything's
go
cool.
Oh, sure.
It's very laid back here.
So, why don't you tell me about your title and then what your job is here?
Right. Well, I'm an acoustics consultant, a senior acoustics consultant.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this our company here, we focus on performing arts, spaces for the performing arts. So, but that's still, I mean, the acoustics we do is still very similar to what any acoustician does. A large part of our work focuses on not what you want to see and hear inside of a concert hall, but keeping the unwanted noise out.
Mm-hmm.
And keeping noise from, you know, machinery and electrical equipment and everything that's in a modern building, keeping it quiet so you don't hear it. That's probably over half of what we do. And then the other part of what we do is the actual designing of rooms. We work with architects on, you know, the shaping and the selection of materials.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's a concert hall or a theater, that its acoustics environment is appropriate and for the types of performances that'll happen.
Mm-hmm.
What else do acousticians do? Noise control, room design. As an acoustician, I'm very interested in it. My role stops short of the actual any electroacoustics or speakers or performance sound that falls to Jeff.
Mm-hmm.
Though of course, the room shaping is, you know, it's related, obviously.
So, what sounds do you remember from childhood?
Ooh, excellent.
I'm just curious how
that's a unique question.
You have a unique job.
Yeah, I remember. Let's see here. I remember roosters, because we had this rooster. Our neighbor had a rooster. We didn't live on a farm or anything, but so it was
Key West.
Kind of.
No,
I grew up in Seattle, actually.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, I remember that rooster. I remember the sounds of weather, thunderstorms. Remember, it's hard to say whether I remember the sound of my mother's voice because I've heard my father's voice because I've heard them my entire life. So, you know, I can picture their voice, but
mm-hmm.
not necessarily from them.
What did it sound like?
Someone talking. My mother was more of a female voice. My father was more of a male voice.
They didn't swap sometimes.
not to my knowledge.
Oh, okay. You're very specific about making sure they have the right noises.
Yeah. What other sounds are? Actually, I didn't really listen to music when I was like really young.
Mm-hmm.
Though.
Well,
I am
a
musician.
That's what the parents do. You're a musician.
Yeah, and I'm an amateur musician. And I had a lot of music growing up. But as far as my early childhood, like pre-age 8, no. I don't know how else I can answer that question.
So what sounds do you hear most now?
I mostly hear sounds that I wish I wasn't hearing. Like the sounds of the city,
mm-hmm.
construction, clients complaining.
Are they complaining about noise all the time?
No, well, that was sort of a joke. No, I don't mind listening to my clients.
Okay.
Those are good noises.
Edit that out. Okay.
Yeah. Sounds of cars.
Mm-hmm. What's it sound
that,
like?
That the music the kids listen to these days, play it too loud. Yeah, just most man-made noises other than music I don't want to hear. I don't hear enough of the sounds of nature. You know, like we have a little stream by our house, which is,
mm-hmm.
you know, a block or two. It's across the street, but that's a pleasant sound. That's what we like to hear. That's what I like to hear.
Well, thank you. I'm going to ask Jeff to talk about his job now. His title.
My job, yes.
Your title and...
Well,
what you do here.
I too am a senior consultant
mm-hmm.
here at ArtTech, and I design sound systems
mm-hmm.
And production communication systems for these performing arts facilities that Todd was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Primarily in the types of facilities that we do, they range. In size, the venues range in size from, you know, small theaters from a few hundred seats to large concert halls, 2,000 plus seats. So I'm designing primarily sound reinforcement systems, so loudspeakers and mixing consoles and all the digital processing that goes into that for all those different venues. So the systems range in size. And then the other systems I design relate to the communications that need to happen within a performance facility for rehearsals and productions. So intercom systems, which allow the technical crew,
mm-hmm.
Stage management to talk to each other during rehearsals and performances. What we call a program paging system, which is a way that, say, stage managers can page performers in their dressing rooms, or that house managers can page the patrons out in the lobby to tell them that the performance is about to begin, or that someone has left their lights on or something. And the third communication system is production video, which allows performers and technical crew to see what's going on stage via a camera that's mounted out in the venue that's looking at the stage.
Camera?
Well, it is similar to a surveillance camera in that it is a closed circuit, either color or black and white. So those are the systems that I design, and you know, in relation to the acoustics of the room, as Todd was talking about before, and the sound system, how they relate to each other. Todd, as an acoustics designer of the room, will. Ask for elements of acoustic elements that are variable, so that say a curtain such as this can be drawn in an audience area when the reinforcement system is being used, so that the reverb time, the amount of time that it takes for sound to die out in the room, is reduced, which is more conducive to sound system use, as opposed to a purely acoustic performance such as in a concert hall. You would want that retracted so that you had a longer reverb time.
So what's the most absorbent material for for sound. Do you guys know this?
Yes.
Todd?
Todd?
An open window.
Yes.
100% absorptive.
So like
or an outdoor theater. I mean, you don't get any reflections back.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a concert hall, you're actually trying to make use of reflections off the walls to give you the feeling in a space.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of the experience. It's part of what people desire. But, I mean, in terms of, let's say you have walls and you want to absorb the sound, anything soft and fuzzy really isn't as good as an open window, but usually very inexpensive materials like fiberglass insulation or fabric. So the problem is they tend to absorb, we say it's frequency dependent. In other words, it absorbs higher frequency pitches, but what's very difficult to control, whether it's in a concert hall or in your living room or in an urban environment, is low frequency noise, the rumble, which just because of the physical nature of low frequency sound waves, it's very difficult to control and absorb. So that's always the challenge. And the only way to deal with that is either to have an open window or to have a large cavity, a bass trap, you know. It's a challenge in recording studios to deal with low frequencies. There's different ways of creating tuned resonant cavities to absorb bass.
So how do you make it quiet? Like, what's quiet? How do you know when it's
well,
quiet?
Well, you'll know it's quiet. I mean, 99.73% of the population probably has never experienced complete silence. I mean, noise below the threshold of audibility, to the point where if you walk into such a space, you actually feel one's reaction is usually, it's a very uncomfortable feeling. You begin to hear your heartbeat, you begin to hear light ringing in your ears you've never heard before, because they're used to this certain level of background noise. I mean, here it's relatively quiet, but I can hear the whirl of your
mini disc
recorder.
Yeah, I normally can't hear my mini disc except when I start it up, but I can hear it going.
Yeah,
it seems really loud.
You can hear the whirl of the server room next door, at least I can. And, you know, this is a room, for example, that is about the quietest room we have.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not on an exterior wall. And, you know, I put up some absorptive fabric, but one thing I do when I'm fooling around here with a DAT recorder or something is I put on headphones and I turn the gain up.
Mm-hmm.
And you can still, you know, every time a truck or any vehicle goes down the street, you hear the rumble because it's those low frequencies which come right through. But technically, complete quiet is actually our design criteria for, I would say, a world-class concert hall. So we've achieved that, whether it's locally, for example, the New Jersey Performing Arts Center is geographically the closest space, which if you could do an A-B comparison between that and Carnegie Hall, you know, Carnegie Hall is a great hall, but it's not really quiet at all. You can sit, you know, if you had the luxury of sitting in a completely empty hall, you can hear subways, you can hear the ventilation system. But in New Jersey Performing Arts Center, when we first opened and commissioned the space, the levels are so low that not only can you not hear it, but it's very difficult finding an instrument that will be able to measure sound levels that low, a sound level meter that can measure sound levels that low to prove it meets the design criteria. Because it's not a common application. Usually in a typical residence or office, there's a lot of tolerance for noise caused by, you know, ventilation systems or air conditioning motors, because that's an acceptable environment for an office. It doesn't interfere with normal conversation, or according to studies, it doesn't interfere with sleep or normal day-to-day activities, but it would be a problem. You know, if you get musicians in that type of space, and if they're rehearsing, trying to create serious music, it will interfere with them being able to perform and listen to each other mm-hmm. at their best.
So, you guys use a sound pressure reader?
Yeah, we use an SLM, sound mm-hmm. level meter. Mm-hmm. We have one. I could show it to you in a second. Actually, our company, almost every acoustics consulting engineer or engineering firm will own one or more sound level meters. Mm-hmm. We actually don't use it on a day-to-day basis because of the types of projects we work on. We don't open a new concert hall every day. Mm-hmm. We work on very large and complex projects typically. We work on smaller projects too, but we don't go out and measure dogs barking or mm-hmm. typical environmental noise complaints. So,
but we'd like to today.
Right. I mean, we certainly can. Of course. We certainly can, but it's not our bread and butter. Mm-hmm. So we have one sound level meter, which is very old, but it works, because mm-hmm. actually the newer sound level meters are like computers. They're getting packed and packed with more and more features
mm-hmm.
Geared like towards what the average person or average professional mm-hmm. will use. But as a result, you know, you're packing technology into a smaller package, and they're actually getting to be noisier. So they're unable to measure all the way down to subjective mm-hmm. silence. But the features in a sound level meter are that it can, of course, it records, which sounds like that would be obvious, but mm-hmm. our sound level meter actually gives instantaneous readings. But if you want to record, you have to actually sit with a pad and write it down. It's not meant to, you know, for example, a big thing is noise from aircrafts, airports. A big deal in today's world. So a lot of sound level, some consultants who do that kind of work will go out and they'll have a sound level meter, they'll lock it in a box and they'll let it sit for 24 hours and it'll record. So like every minute they know what the sound levels are, so they can actually look and see where the airplane passbys are and what times the peak events are, and you know, what's the average sound level between 11 p.m. and 7 a.m., which is has a different, you have to interpret that differently than sound levels during the day, because mm-hmm. when people are trying to sleep, you know, that's important. Whereas we just typically will go into concert hall and measure the room. It has to be quiet all the time. That's mm-hmm. the deal.
So is it possible then to take the decibel reader out and measure the construction that's nearby?
We could take like an instantaneous reading. Though I think we have to be careful with all those strikers out there. We go out there with a funny looking instrument.
Strikers?
Yeah, there's.
We can definitely measure out the window and maybe. I wish it was a recording device, because then we mm-hmm. could like stick it in our backpack with a right. with the microphone right. just sticking out and walk around and mm-hmm. read it later. But this one, you kind of have to stand there.
Let's try it out.
Yeah.
Do you want to head out?
Sure.
You're not off the hook about sound memories either.
Just what's that?
Not off the hook about sound memories.
It's my traveling case. We lasted
UPS.
The noise measurements in Budapest, Hungary. So it's a challenge smuggling these things across the border. I mean, no. microphone. Oh, this might be.
Wow, that looks really 50s sci-fi.
Well, the thing is, yeah.
And
but
it's got that mint green casing.
They don't look that like
a
different.
Yeah. Wand like at the end.
Yeah, this company, Brilliant Cure, which is a handful of companies that make the top end sound level meters.
Not American.
They've kept the same. The same. All their machines have been the same color for forever.
Mm-hmm. It's rather pretty.
You'll notice it has all these
half-inch
calibration stickers all over it.
Yes, yes, everything's
it's
in
got this. The stained red wooden box with a mint green sci-fi box here. Okay.
And this is a
what is that?
Half-inch microphone. Ruling here, they also, before they split, they used to also make professional audio microphones, too.
Mm-hmm.
And there's probably not much difference between this and, like, a B&K 4006. I mean, it's just a...
It's just a
condenser microphone. Nothing fancy, but it's all calibrated to NIST traceable standards. So we'll do a little calibration here.
Okay.
That should calibrate
another pretty
to
object.
Should calibrate to about 83.5 or so.
What is that?
83.5 decibels.
Okay.
Oh.
Is it too quiet in here?
No, I didn't have my polarization voltage turned on.
Oh.
I do that all the time.
You should make little notes for yourself. Your hand polarization.
Yeah, right. Write something on your hand. Polarization voltage.
And why are you putting that up to your ear?
Just to make sure it's on. It's just the way
it
automatically.
Like a seashell, so.
No.
Okay.
It produces a 1,000 hertz tone at a calibrated level. And okay, it's close enough for what we're going to do. It's within. I mean, this is usually within a tenth of a decibel, which is
really good.
This is nothing like your Radio Shack sound level meter, which are nice devices, but that usually has a lower limit of measuring around 55 dB in the low range. It's meant for,
yeah.
I mean,
it's meant
for norm, for middle,
for live sound.
Yeah, it's meant
stuff,
for guys
right?
who are at the local club who are gonna, you know, make sure that they're not bludgeoning people's ears too much. And,
right.
So they don't really need something that's very accurate.
Accurate, or it's just easier to measure loud levels than quiet levels. We're trying to measure silence essentially. So.
We're starting here. This is quiet down here. So what is it at right now?
Okay, I'm just going to do an A-weighted dB average. Normally, when we do a measurement, we measure in all the octave bands. We step through and do that because what the actual spectrum is very important. Most of the time, if you take your Radio Shack sound level meter or this in the A-weighted setting, you're measuring a single number. But you can have, say, a 55 dB environment that's very rumbly sounding, or you can have a 55 dB environment that actually has a very neutral spectrum. And, so technically the same A-weighted sound reading, but one will be considered annoying because you hear this rumble, and another one might be perfectly tolerable. So we're just going to do the A-weighted, because otherwise we have to step there. Or we can do the A-weighted and then maybe do one reading just to kind of gauge the overall low-frequency noise pollution of this horribly noisy world we live in. Okay, so let's all be quiet.
Okay.
Cheryl.
Being noisy.
Without her talking, this reads about 28.
Okay.
There's an 11.5 calibration factor, so 39.5 A-weighted decibels.
Pretty quiet office environment, indoors. Okay.
If that's what you think. Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, I guess this this is, I guess, fairly typical. You have computers and stuff.
I mean, it's probably
we actually don't have,
usually
we don't have
most
air conditioning
offices
equipment.
Are,
so.
Are noisy.
I mean, probably, you know, out here is more typical in that,
yeah.
like, you know, there's more just of the general noise. Mm-hmm. I mean, if that was someone's private office, yeah, that's probably what you expect, but in a typical office environment in New York City, probably with the HVAC going and
mm-hmm.
noise from outside.
Yeah.
And
it's a fairly
you know,
quiet office. Down here, anyway.
Yeah.
So you guys want
to
take
try,
that?
Want to try measuring like, at the window at this level, then we can
okay.
maybe compare that.
Once we're outside.
Do an experiment
yeah.
of how, what height does.
There we go.
Mm-hmm.
This window is open.
It's already pretty noisy. Okay, we're going to
the
window here. What floor are we on? Or the 12th?
11th floor.
11th floor. Construction going on. Down on the 8th floor, maybe.
Well, that, there, that's a new building from just before the, that level this on Friday. You can watch the whole process.
Well, just averaging my eye here, I would say it's hovering around 60 or so. At a, let's just call it about average of about 70 dBA. Now, when you hear them through a
wait,
piece
what
of.
What was it back there?
39. So the textbooks say that the average level of a human conversation is about 16 dB. Yeah. Now, first, when he throws a piece of formwork down on the ground, you hear all of a sudden it just goes off the scale. So this is like an average level. Peak noises are a whole different world. I mean, you listen to the average level, you can kind of tune it out. But if you're going down the street and all of a sudden a big truck blows its air horn or something, not only do you notice it more, but it can cause hearing loss, or at least temporary hearing loss, because your auditory system, if it's a really loud environment, to a certain extent it will kind of lower its sensitivity and protect itself. But when all of a sudden a big sudden loud noise event happens, then you get shocked and your ear might ring, and hopefully that's only temporary. It's noise, it's bad, bad, bad.
Well, do you want to head outside?
Okay.
Let's
try this.
Come on, we're taking
we'll
it outside.
Don't worry,
he's
they don't care.
He's tucking his shoe.
Okay, you hold it.
I'll hold it. The issue is that there's this cement worker out there.
Oh.
Who've been picketing because
there's the strikers.
Well, they're not striking. They're protesting the fact that the construction site is using non-union
mm-hmm.
cement workers to do the work. So.
Mm-hmm.
So they've been out there basically just making noise.
Did you say before that they were throwing things or what was happening?
They were blocking cement trucks from coming through to get to the site.
Oh no.
Because they're cement workers, they didn't want any cement to be poured, so they all got on the front of the cement truck to stop it from moving, and then cops had to come, and some of them got taken away. The ones that wouldn't get off the front of the cement
truck. What do you mean taken away?
They were arrested.
Really?
Yeah.
So, now that we're about to go in an elevator,
yeah.
a tiny elevator, what sound memories do you have from childhood?
Do I have from childhood?
Yeah.
Well, I have
it's
a little
about time. You have to answer that question.
I know. Well, I had a little bit of a lead time because she asked it to you, and now I got to think about it. You know. Yeah, right? Now I have to have a little story. No, the only story I have is things I remember from childhood are, you know, we were talking about that we miss nature sounds, and I think that the sounds of nature are the things that I most remember from childhood because I grew up out in the woods, and
mm-hmm.
and
since it's springtime, mm-hmm. right now, you know, you hear those birds that you only hear in springtime, and so I heard one the other day that actually reminded me of one that I heard all the time during my childhood. I'm not sure what kind of bird
it
is. It's like a, I'll whistle it. It's like a, like that. Oh. And they just, it's a very kind of nice, mournful,
yeah. Uh-huh.
You know,
yeah,
thing.
I'll call it.
Yeah.
But the other thing, too, is crickets in the mm-hmm. summertime. Incredibly loud.
Aww.
Incredibly loud.
Where are you guys? Like, wait, where did you go?
I grew up in in Connecticut, but it was very much in the woods. And so in the summertime, when it was hot,
running,
I mean,
yeah, town,
you know, hot summer night, all the windows open.
What sounds do you hear most now?
Ruskin? No.
You're getting one.
Mostly urban stuff, you know. At the office, it's this construction.
Are we getting more donation checks?
You know, horns and sirens. The fire department uses 26th Street a lot when they, for some reason, it's a good cross street for them. So sirens a lot.
To work around here too.
Yeah. Right. And of course, they can't get through very quickly. So it's, you know, because the traffic, they're blocked in, so they just keep the siren going, and it just, you know, goes on and on and on. You know, at home in Brooklyn, it's a little bit less of this type
Don't
of stuff.
Don't you hear birds in Brooklyn?
Oh yeah, I do, and that's the ones that reminded me of my childhood. But there's still, you know, there's still the cars that zoom down the street every once in a while. But mostly, actually, more what you hear in Brooklyn is the neighbors yelling at each other and stuff like that. Sure.
All right, we're going to check out the sound.
We move down to the freight elevator. You can see the barricades are set up for these guys to stand in. And they've got their sign that says, Honk Union Yes.
Honk Union Yes. So they're asking people to make lots of noise here.
Right, they are.
Okay.
So Todd's got the meter in the bag, as it were.
We're all covert here. Were you not allowed to take it outside?
No, I'm just very
cautious.
I'm a very self-conscious acoustician. It's always very interesting going through airports with this equipment. Because most, a lot of the screening personnel don't know what it is, and mm-hmm. they ask questions, and usually I can convince them that it's not a weapon.
What kind of questions do they ask?
Just what is it? And a lot of them don't know when I say it's acoustics equipment.
Like, what's
I guess
acoustic?
Not everyone knows what the word acoustics.
No.
A lot of people don't. They know what sound is. So then I say it's a sound measuring device.
Sound.
Which is they say, what do? You measure a rock concert or whatever? I say, yeah. You know, whatever to help them understand, even though it's mm-hmm. not the truth. Okay, we're actually not far off from where we were at the window. There's not that much
really?
Difference. And I think probably what that is because the plane where
yes.
the sound is radiating from is actually, like, if you
above us.
If you look from the window, you see a large area where the work is occurring. Mm-hmm. But now we're only seeing a sliver of that. So a lot of the sound is being projected upwards and not as much as being projected here. So even though we're further away, the sound is a little bit directional, so it's getting up very efficiently to those windows.
Is it because it's dissipating? You said earlier the air, like, window is best, so there's kind of like a big open window in front of them. There's walls behind them, and it's like carrying the sound up,
and also
channeling
it up. Like, yeah, the walls of the building are containing the sound and kind of forcing
it out
in this direction. So what we're hearing from the window is probably sound, direct sound, but also reflections off the side of the building, mm-hmm. and they reinforce each other. Yeah.
Cool.
That's right.
Okay. Was it louder than this at all? Did they do any pile driving, jackhammering?
Well, there was one day, I think it was probably the week before last, that they didn't complete the entire cement pour. And I guess you can't continue the pour where you left off. You have to pour basically on the form, mm-hmm.
And so what they had to do is they had to jackhammer up all this slag. Mm-hmm. It's called slag, the part that doesn't get in the form. And they said they spent an entire day jackhammering.
Yeah.
Which was loud.
I listened to jackhammering. It's pretty bad. But you know what? I was my job, they had pile driver.
Oh,
it was
yeah,
constant
for
like weeks. Oh,
those are bad, too.
Really loud.
I can mess with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to measure those sounds. I think that's something that would go way off the chart.
Yeah. And apparently the jackhammers they use now are much quieter than the ones they used to use. Because
really?
I guess they have mufflers.
Yeah, right.
Alan Teplitsky, you know, someone this office who is now retired, who's worked in noise control for a few centuries, remembers back when they used to use non-muffled jackhammers. But also what's amazing is how many people don't use ear protection when they're operating the machinery.
Yeah.
And I'm standing over, you know, pretty far away, and often I'll plug my ears, but they're working right up against it.
Yeah, I've
and,
seen people using jackhammers with nothing.
They probably have already sustained permanent hearing loss, so they don't even notice it anymore. And, you know, it's over for them.
Yeah. Or even pension retirement sometimes, or the MTA will test people's hearing just about when they're supposed to reach, like, pension or something at 25 years.
Oh, yeah.
They'll say, oh, you lost your hearing, so you're not qualified for this last year of work, and they'll fire them just before they get,
retire. That's ridiculous.
It happens quite frequently. Well, so I wonder if the same thing happens, union job. Maybe you're protected more at different unions.
Well, you're outside
the MTA.
Well, like we're talking about what's happening here is that these guys are non-union, so like...
Oh, so it doesn't matter if they...
So it doesn't matter.
Oh. I have earplugs in my bag. I think I'm going to...
Yeah,
I wonder if I can throw them over the fence to them.
Yeah, right?
I have earplugs to give them.
Earplugs are a good thing to have in New York, no matter what you're doing.
Yeah.
There's a lot of loud stuff.
What's it say? Do not enter. Oh, okay. Well, I have baggies of earplugs. Maybe I should throw them over the side. You think I should?
I think it's a really good thought, and I think you're supporting the right people, but unfortunately, I think if you did anything in this situation... That you might, you know, come
it's
some physical
hostile.
Harm. Yeah, I mean, no one's here right now, so it's fortunate because there's no concrete work going on. But,
Well, hopefully, maybe I'll leave my cards about giant ear and they'll listen to you.
Yeah, we could do that
they can
too.
Hear anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Listen.
You could try.
Save your hearing. Well. Well, I want to thank you guys for bringing that out here. Oh, did we get another reading? What is it at now?
That one was was about 8 dB higher with that going past. And that's a lot. You can feel, when those little trucks pass, you can physically feel it. It's more than just your ears hearing it.
Yeah.
But that was about 8 dB higher, so 68 plus 10 or close to 80 dB when that passed. And that wouldn't be a maximum either. We were working on, often when we start a project, you know, a completely new project, we will go out and we will measure the environmental noise levels, because that will tell us how thick we have to make the walls and all the way down to some new construction we do involves floating the whole building on giant rubber pads, so the whole building is floating like a... The Jazz at Lincoln Center, the Rose Theater there, is actually completely floating on rubber pads to isolate it from the subway noise.
Wow.
But anyway, we do some measurements of the background noise, and we did a project up in Toronto, which is at a university, and the building is right next to kind of the main drag where all the buses drive. And there were... sound levels were like reached 93 dB. Big diesel buses, very loud.
Wow. Thanks. We have to end there. Thank you very much for bringing that out.
Sure.
Nice meeting you.
Nice meeting you.
Thanks.
Hey, yeah.
Thank
I'll
you.
See you sometime
All
soon.
Right.
I'm sure.
Okay. Take care.
Thank you. Hello Peter, it's Michelle. Just ring because I gave it some thought about the sounds, my favourite sounds in London, and a couple that I thought of were the fountain in Victoria Park at night. If you go through it about 2 o'clock in the morning when it's really, really quiet, and you just hear this fountain in the middle of the water, very gentle. So I like that. And I like the sound when you go through the Blackwall Tunnel, sort of inside the car, especially when you slow down at the corners. So I like that. And an obvious one, but it's Big Ben. But it's not so much the sounds of the striking, but the kind of space between them, waiting for the next one. And Regent's Park Zoo, early evening when the park's empty and you cycle past and you stop and you hear strange sounds and it's really still. And when I lived on Lavender Hill, my favourite sound was the traffic at night. It used to help me sleep. So those are a few. Bye.
I started making circuits when I was a wee shaver, and when I went to university, I was fortunate. I worked with Alvin Lucier for many years, and I was a member of David Tudor's ensemble, and I worked with David Behrman and some other people who were part of the sort of first generation of American folk electronic instrument makers. In other words, these guys were making silicon banjos back in the days that your grandparents were hugging and kissing on the back seats of wide American cars. Think about that, right? And I never learned electronics in any proper way. And so in that way, I'm like all the rest of you. It's just I've been doing things wrong longer than most people. What does that mean? I make more mistakes and statistically probably stand a slightly higher chance of having gotten something done right. Though I will have to say, the first circuit took a long time to come out right. And a few years ago, I started teaching for the first time in my life. The freelance life was narrowing the waistline beyond the level of acceptable survival. So I've been teaching for the last several years at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, which, poignantly enough, has a department of sound. It's not a department of music, it's a department of sound. And when I tell people that, they always say, oh, is there also like a department of light? You know, a department of weight? I wish there were, but it's a very nice place to work. And it's, as academic jobs, I don't know if I could say this on tape, as academic jobs go, it's a no-brainer. Can you use that term? Maybe in art school it's like par for the course. I don't know. I don't know much. But I discovered something interesting, that after years of working with electronics and then working with computers in live performance, the school was totally digital. Everybody was using computers for everything, from illustration to movie editing to, I don't know, creating fiber works. But at the end of the day, they were artists, and they liked to do things with their hands. And they were always trying to figure out ways of connecting the physical world to computers. So I started giving people advice on what I call glue technology. I have this beautiful computer program, but it's supposed to do something when someone sits in a chair. How do I make that work? Well, put the keyboard under the cushion. You know, I mean, I start with very simple suggestions. So after a number of these, I decided that I should offer a class in real sort of seat-of-the-pants electronics for people who really didn't want to waste time on theory. And one could say this is just a slightly parallel stream to the glorious tradition of circuit bending. It just comes from a slightly different background and sometimes has a slightly different endpoint. So over a few years, I worked out a number of projects and ways of sort of getting basic electronics across to people without stopping for very long to think of why something is working. And basically, the emphasis of what I do is on two things. It's on ways of listening. That is, I think a lot of circuit bending is about ways of making sound and ways of making things that make sound. And a lot of what I do is more about figuring out ways to listen rather than produce sound. So we do a lot of making sort of alternative microphones, contact mics, coils, making microphones out of odd objects that you wouldn't think could act as a microphone. We end up doing some sort of classic bending, but then we make circuits from scratch. I sort of ran through the great cosmology of circuits and picked those circuits that A, worked first time every time, B, had the smallest number of variable components in them, and C, were permutationally combinable. That's the word I'm looking for. So that you could have, say, three or four basic designs and then interconnect them in all sorts of different ways. It's me versus the wattage, isn't it? I'm gonna get you. There is nothing louder than the human voice, as anyone who's been a parent knows, okay? So we make indestructible circuits. Not even John Bowers, the great John Bowers, who all of you know, could destroy these circuits, and that's saying something. And then because it's an art school, we worked a little bit on circuits that make visual impressions, like ways of animating, or shall we say reanimating, the LCDs from dead toys, and ways of hacking video circuits to make video imagery instead of sound. Yeah, so that's it. That's probably enough of an introduction. Now, you guys are probably miles ahead of me in terms of your ability to do actual electronic thingies. You know, I'm kind of like a Luddite. I also know that we got a little window of time here, and I teach in a school where the classes are really long, like 8 hours long. So I'm like the vanilla fudge of educators, for those of you who are old enough to realize what that means. And so to do 2 hours is like doing a 30-second spot for me. What I want to try with you today are things that you don't have to solder to try them, because sometimes it'll take up to 4 minutes for a soldering iron to warm up. And who has time for that? All right? And I'm going to try to do a few things that you might not have picked up from the usual bending lists. And for starters, I'm just going to show you one of the most useful devices in the world. This is a telephone tap. And they're for, in the best of worlds, they're for journalists who want to interview someone on the phone. And you want to record that onto a tape recorder so you can listen to it later and transcribe it. In the real world, this is for when you have what we might say call an adversarial relationship with a landlord or a former loved one. And you think that for purposes of protecting your own backside, it might make sense to document some of these hot conversations. In any case, this is 1/6 of a guitar pickup. All right, this is a little coil of wire wrapped around a slug of iron. At Radio Shack, they cost $3 or $4. If you go to allelectronics.com, great source, $2. And what this is terrific for is picking up the sounds of electromagnetic fields. What does an electromagnetic field sound like? Well, not very exciting, right? Except that there are some things that make noises that you might not expect. Before my wife picks up, I disconnect. All right. One of the most delightful sources of music you can find in this world is the CD player. Enough to bring a laptop to an event like this, you know, which is like wearing orange in the wrong part of Belfast, you should move this over the top of your laptop and you can actually hear what the different parts of your computer are doing. Now, you know, sonification, it's like the new Motown, right? Everyone's talking about it. And you can learn to identify what your computer is doing by ear using this. You can say, oh, that's where my hard drive is. You know, that's where the memory is. That's where the video circuit is. That's where the battery charger is. Because each one of those elements of a computer sends off a different kind of electronic hash. What here in the land of the NSA we call an electronic fingerprint, okay? In fact, there are ways to steal the data from someone else's computer just by eavesdropping with this. Which is why, if you do know any spooks, you will notice that they have RF-plated laptops that are low emission, so that when whoever it is who wants to listen to them is listening, they hear. Okay? So this is like, I consider this to be the stethoscope of the electronic surgeon. In other words, before you take that step too far of opening up your girlfriend/boyfriend/son's toy. This is what's known as non-invasive surgery. This is how you know, is it worth incurring the wrath of said loved one? All right? Now, the reason I bring it up here is twofold. First of all, to tell you, and I stand to get no profit on this, go out and buy one. You would be a fool to go through life without one. There's so much out there worth listening to. Imagine if one day you could be a bat and hear all those sounds that are up like that. Or a whale and hear all those sounds that are down like that. You'd park a few bucks on that option, wouldn't you? So, park a few dollars on getting one of these and plug it into anything. For example, the other thing that's really useful to have to avoid killing yourself in hacking is a battery-powered amplifier. Now, I'm staying with Robert Paus of the legendary Band of Susans. And so, because he is a proper guitarist, instead of having to bring the weeny little $12 Radio Shack amp, I bring the world's smallest twin reverb. And if you turn these things up, you can get... So that's like a Zen koan. You know, what is the sound of one guitar feeding back without the guitar? All right, so this is... Looks like a guitar amp. Doesn't sound like one. But very useful and loud as hell. It really makes a CD player sound like a tractor, doesn't it? Have you noticed that? Yeah, I gotta do the South 40. Now, the reason second reason I pull this out is the first thing we're gonna do. How many of you read the list of workshop supplies? How many of you bothered to bring the things that were on the... There, you see, I know that. This is just like students. Interesting, the people who didn't read it brought the things. That's very cool. All right, we need a portable radio for our first wonderful experiment, for those of you who have them.